This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
Thank you, Shannon. Here's Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and MSU Alumni Association Executive Director Scott Westerman with the retiring editor of the MSU Alumni Magazine, Bob Bau.
Well, it's really our pleasure to welcome Bob Bau to the program. Bob is considered probably the unofficial historian of Michigan State University and someone who has both seen us from afar in some of the work that you've done in the political circle before you came to Michigan State and began working with the Alumni Magazine about, what, 1983, something like
that? Yes, that was my first year.
Yeah, I was sort of in the president's office at that point as a sort of still wet behind the ears of professor trying to do some things. But I know that over the years, I've really felt that I've gotten to know Michigan State through you, not from my own personal experience, from the articles you've written and those kinds of things. So I know that even though we're not going to give you a green paycheck anymore, that you'll still stay very connected to Michigan State. But what would you think about as the one or two most memorable stories from your perspective that you've done?
Oh, man.
And you can't count the recent Rose Bowl, so you have to give me something else.
Well, one of the most stressful moments, in 31 years, happened in 1991 when the late John Hanna passed. That was a year that John Engler, one of our alum, was elected governor.
Right.
And we had planned a cover story, and John Engler succeeded Jim Blanchard, who was our other alumnus who had been governor of Michigan. So we had the cover set, and I was literally at the printing plant ready to start the presses running when I get a phone call informing me that John Hanna had passed and we couldn't possibly, run the magazine. So we had to stop the presses. And I think in the next 7 days, we produced a 10-page cover story on John Hanna. Mm-hmm. And thank God John Engler was an alumnus because he understood why we displaced him from the cover of the magazine. He's very good about
good history. Good history.
Born in Shanghai, raised in Uruguay, graduated from Ohio Wesleyan in 1965. You came to Michigan State for your MBA. Along the way, you've been a political press secretary. You've penned pieces for Time, Life, People, and Fortune, and Money. And you co-authored the popular career textbook, College to Career, right?
Mm-hmm.
College to Career textbook.
With former trustee Jack Shingleton. He was the main author, and I was the co-author.
East Lansing's a long way from Montevideo. What attracted you here?
After I graduated from Ohio Wesleyan, a lot of us went to either the University of Michigan or Michigan State. I think there were probably about 60 of us. 30 went to Michigan, 30 came to Michigan State. Now, a whole bunch also went to Ohio State because Delaware is essentially in suburban Columbus. But I tell you, the reason I picked Michigan State, I was accepted. I applied to both Michigan and Michigan State. But the letter of acceptance and my dealings with Michigan State was a lot friendlier and conducive. Whereas dealing with the University of Michigan, it was more pro forma. And, at my age, that made a huge difference. I felt that I was welcome at Michigan State a lot more. So that's how I ended up coming to Michigan State.
How did you sell the people on hiring you to run a magazine?
Well, back in the early 70s, I actually worked as assistant editor of the Alumni Magazine for a couple of years. That was when Ron Carley was the editor. Jack Kinney was at that time the executive director. And it was a great opportunity, and I loved it. But then I left this area for about 5 years, And that's when all that trouble took place. For those of you, you know, who are mindful of history, there was a big spat that took place between the Alumni Association and the president of the university.
And the Alumni Association in those days was an independent entity.
They had just gone independent. President Mackey, who was newly hired as president in the late 70s, I think opposed the arrangement. And now I wasn't here during all that spat, but I'll never forget seeing the Alumni Magazine turn into kind of a muckraking magazine taking shots at the university, and I knew that was not going to survive, and it didn't. And in 1982, they restarted a new alumni association that was a part of the university. And I think Chuck Webb was the person they hired to get it started. So,
and you came a year later?
I was hired in 82, but I started in 83. And I think the first person that Chuck Webb hired was Clarence Underwood, who later on went on to become the deputy commissioner of the Big Ten. He became the athletics director. I think he's still active today as part of the admissions office. So,
remember what your first article was, the first cover?
Yes, I actually do. My first cover story was James Blanchard, who was the first MSU alumnus to be elected governor of Michigan. And the irony is that the previous year I had worked in a political campaign on the other side. But Jim and I have become good friends over the years. Once you become editor of the Alumni Magazine, the only politics that counts is being green and white, and that's what I've tried to be.
And there wasn't any initial discomfort in that relationship?
No, I think from the get-go, it worked really well. You know, I was able to spend the day with him doing, you know, his campaign, and we did the story, and I recently ran into Blanchard. I think it was at Pentwater, and he still remembered that very fondly.
It's amazing how time heals all wounds, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing.
You've been all over the world on this assignment. What are some of the fascinating places that you've been to as the editor of the Alumni Magazine?
Well, as editor of the Alumni Magazine, I've had a chance, you know, to travel around the world hosting some of the alumni tours. One of the ones that I did recently that I recommend to everybody is the Odyssey to Oxford. At one point, the Odyssey to Oxford was ranked among the top five travel study programs by the Los Angeles Times. It's an incredible program. I think Michigan State is the only university that Oxford has a relationship with. And, you know, Oxford is one of the greatest world universities. I mean, you talk about brand name, you know, they were founded in the 13th century and they've been growing ever since. And it's quite an amazing experience because you actually are taught by Oxford Dons, an amazing, you know, group. And Scott, I think you've been there, so you know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. And you did a great job of documenting that in your blog. When you think about Oxford, what was the thing that touched you the most from that trip?
Well, I think the people that I was with, you're with 60-some people, half of them alumni of Michigan State, who have the same curiosity to learn that you have, and at one of the greatest environments for learning around. And I think that's the part that really, and the idea that this is only available to alumni of Michigan State and then whoever we care to invite to be our partners.
You've had the unique experience of being one of the few to have witnessed firsthand several MSU Rose Bowl experiences. How have they been different?
Well, I tell you what, somebody was just asking me about that. I came here in 65 when we went to the 66 Rose Bowl. And believe it or not, I signed up on the student tour, and we had a lot of fun. I don't remember very many details. We lost the game, but it was an incredible experience because just the 2.5 day bus trip, I don't know that I could survive something like that today.
Yeah, I don't think any of us could. But it was from East Lansing to LA.
From East Lansing to Pasadena. It was an amazing thing. Then, of course, in 88, I was part of the Alumni Association, and I was one of the planners, just as you did this particular one. But I was very involved in the planning of that particular tour, which was it was then described in newspapers as the largest non-military movement of personnel from one part of the country to the other ever, because I think the official tour took something like 5,000 people. And another 5,000 found their ways out there. So it was huge. Obviously, this one broke all the records. I mean, there had to be at least 60,000 folks. You know, with television, back in 66, we had television, but I think it was black and white. And not as many homes had television sets.
Wow.
But they were all great experiences, and, you know, hopefully there'll be a lot more. But, you know, Mark D'Antonio talks about, what was his word, about completing circles, completion. I think it's great timing that I came here on a Rose Bowl year, and now I'm retiring on another Rose Bowl year.
Like Halley's Comet.
Yeah, 2014. But hopefully in retirement, I'll be able to go to a couple more. So,
who are your favorite football coaches over those years?
Well, one of the coaches that I got to know the best was George Perlis, because he started the same year that I did in 1983. And I can still remember my first interview with him. We did it in a diner off of Trowbridge Road, and because I think George was still looking for a place to stay, you know, in East Lansing. And there was a huge snowstorm the day before, and he had arranged for us to meet at 7 a.m. Well, I got there about 7:20, and George says, "No, you'll have to see me another time because you didn't get here on time." And I said, "Yeah, but there was a snowstorm." And she says, "Well, I was here on time." So that, and I knew at that point George was going to be successful because he was a stickler for timeliness.
We all like to play the game. If you could invite anybody over for dinner as a dinner companion, who would that be? And you've talked to a lot of those people over the years. Who are some of your most fascinating interviews?
The most fun I ever had was going to Magic Johnson's New Year's Eve party in the 88 Rose Bowl. I mentioned that to somebody, and now everybody has heard that particular story. But, you know, Magic is obviously bigger than life, and he's a guy that I would, you know, really enjoy spending more time with. Just because of his love for Michigan State, his success, you know, he's turned into really a smart businessman. I mean, he's enjoying as much success now in the business world as he did on the court. It's really fascinating to see his evolution as a great basketball player, a local basketball player who's now become not just a successful businessman, but a personality, a brand name in himself.
Let me throw some more Spartan personalities at you to get your reaction and maybe your memories of them. Some will be famous and some will not be so famous. What are your recollections of President John Hanna?
Well, I tell you what, John Hanna, my diploma is signed by John Hanna. So that's like carbon dating my, you know, my age, but John Hanna, if you read the history of what he has done with this institution, You know, very few presidents cast a shadow as long as John Hanna cast on Michigan State. This was Michigan Agricultural College. It was a very, very small school at the level, you know, of maybe an Adrian or an Albion college that he essentially transformed into the term that was used back in the 50s was megaversity. And literally, he built the university up. I think John Hanna anticipated the return of the GIs, was able to get all the funding he needed from the state legislature, was able to sell the concept of Michigan State as, you know, this university that would serve the whole population, the returning GI population. You know, he's the guy who brought the cyclotron here. You guys were talking about EFRIB earlier, which is one of the – it's a great accomplishment by Luana Salmon to get that. But that would not have been possible if John Hanna had not hired Henry Blossett to build that cyclotron in the first place. And he had the vision that he could turn Michigan State into something bigger than a small agricultural college. And so I got to know John Hanna later in life, and I wish I could have spent more time with him. The problem is that he was very, very humble, and I wanted him to talk about some of his coups, some of his victories. For example, getting us into the Big Ten, which was a major, major coup for the university. But he kind of deflected praise. He says, oh, give the credit to the president of the University of Minnesota. You know, give him the credit. John Hanna was the mastermind, and make no mistake about that.
You're listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
And you're listening to a conversation between Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon, MSU Alumni Association Executive Director Scott Westerman, and the retiring editor of the MSU Alumni Magazine, Bob Baum.
Barney Rosenberg, the inventor of the great cancer drug cisplatin.
You know, I never knew Barney Rosenberg. I did a cover story on him about 2 or 3 years ago, and I got to know his widow. But it's an incredible story that's been documented because, as far as I know, cisplatin and carboplatin, that's the number one anti-cancer drug in the world. And even if somebody doesn't use it directly, it's used in combination with one of the other drugs. It has been the single most effective anti-cancer drug ever, you know, invented. And the amazing thing is Barney Rosenberg was not a chemist. You know, I think he was like a physicist of some kind. But in doing one of his experiments, he noted that when you put platinum in this particular compound, it had a certain effect. And so he thought outside the box and found that a medical application, and sure enough, it looks like a compound with the presence of platinum could fight, you know, cancer cells. But that was a totally serendipitous invention. I think over the years, it's resulted in more income to Michigan State than any other invention that we've had. You know, as far as royalty income.
The great character actor from radio and television, who's probably had his voice on more commercials and more cartoons than anybody, but maybe is one of the least known names, is Dick Beals.
Oh.
Talk about Dick.
You know, Dick was such a great fan of Michigan State. I ran into him every year. Well, he came back to campus a lot, and one year he spoke at homecoming. He was our homecoming speaker for the Green and White luncheon. But I ran into Dick every year at the Big Ten kickoff. I used to do that every year in Chicago and do the and stage the alumni reception, you know, that was always done in connection with that. And Dick would always fly out there from California. And I don't know if you know this, but Dick Beals was also a football coach and a football announcer out in Escondido. So he knew a lot about football. He knew about, formations. He knew a lot more football than I did. And he used to interview these coaches, and I kind of listened to him. You know, it was just amazing. I have a great story to tell you about Dick Beals. Dick Beals was a small person. I don't know what the correct terminology is.
He had the great gift of what sounded, when you looked at him and listened to him, as perpetual childhood. That
right.
made him very famous as Speedy Alka-Seltzer and Davy and Davy and Goliath and a number of classic. I mean, he was on the Lone Ranger a number of times.
Right. He did the voices almost all those Saturday morning cartoons. One of the children's voices typically could have been Dick Beals. You know, he was ubiquitous as a voice actor. So he could play a child of 8, of 10, of 12. I mean, he could just switch it on. He was also a pilot. And he was telling me that one day he came into the local airport in his plane. And when he touched base with the control tower folks, he turned on his 8-year-old voice. And the controllers were saying, son, is your father there? And he would tell them, no, I'm by myself, and created absolute panic in the control tower. But, you know, I don't think you and I can pull that off. But when he decided to turn on his 8-year-old voice, he sounded exactly like an 8-year-old. This is a great story.
A number of politicians have crossed our campus during your time here. Which one fascinated you the most?
You know, the one that we had the biggest production here that I was involved in was Bill Clinton, who spoke at a commencement. I can't remember what year, but it was when Peter McPherson was president. And that was pretty amazing because Bill Clinton, he's probably one of the best politicians who ever lived. I saw him do the room. And until you see a guy in person, it's hard to gauge how good he is. But he had an incredible presence, shook everybody's hand, and looked you in the eye. He was amazing. We've had a lot of famous politicians come here. You know, going back to the days of Teddy Roosevelt, who spoke at the 1917 commencement.
And you weren't there for that.
No, that was a little before my time.
As the official historian, you're supposed to be able to travel through time like Sparty does.
But there are great stories. You know, John F. Kennedy spoke in front of the Union after he spoke at the University of Michigan, and he was advancing the idea of the Peace Corps. They actually have a plaque at the University of Michigan Union denoting where John F. Kennedy spoke in announcing that particular program. But after Ann Arbor, he came to Michigan State and spoke in front of our union. So,
he was practicing that speech in Ann Arbor.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I think Richard Nixon spoke here before he was elected president. You know, I think he may have been vice president. But there have been Eleanor Roosevelt not only was on campus, but she was in an elevator in the union that was stopped. And so she was in there for a little while before they brought her out. It was a funny incident. So there have been a lot of famous presidents that have come by.
You know, I've joked with you for a number of years that your picture in the alumni magazine is still the one with that IBM XT behind you, and technology has just revolutionized the way we do the magazine. How has the whole publication business changed during your time here?
That's a great question, Scott. You know, when I first started in this, and I told you I started in the 1970s, I was an assistant editor. Back then, believe it or not, the magazine was typeset by hand. We used to go out to a place on Michigan Avenue called Capital Type. It no longer exists, where somebody actually set everything in these galley boxes with lead type by hand. And it was just amazing, you know. And because today, as you know, everything is done it's via computers, and it's a computer to press. You actually don't see galley proofs the way you did traditionally. And the entire magazine occupies a bunch of gigabytes on a drive, so it's held by a bunch of bits and bytes in electronic form, which you take in a flash drive over to the printer, and they download that, and from there, that's how they assemble the magazine for printing. So it's been an incredible transformation. In the area of desktop publishing, I still remember going back a few years in the early days of the computer. We had a program that involved 10 CDs that you had to download into your computer, and then from there you had a very clumsy way of putting the pages together. Of course, today with programs like InDesign, which is what most people use, it's just so easy to make changes and design pages and float text in. You know, it's just an amazing advance.
Do you think printed versions of alumni magazines will ever go away? Will it all be electronic at some point?
Well, I don't think it's going away anytime soon, because we've done surveys, and most alumni want the alumni magazine in a way that they can hold in their hands and put on their coffee tables, as opposed to, you know, something that comes across their email. And this is true across all ages. You might think that it's the old fogies who want it, you know, in a magazine format, but we found that even younger alums want it that way. So
I think I've heard you say at one point that the one thing that has never changed about the magazine is it's all about how you tell the story.
Right. You know, the goal of all alumni magazines is really to connect alumni to the university and reconnect alumni with each other. I mean, it's a pretty simple formula. And I think, you know, you have to be able to tell stories that are of interest to alumni. Our mission statement is that the alumni magazine is a quality magazine that serves both alumni and the university. I mean, I'm compressing it. We use more flowery language than that. But it's a lot easier to sell the good things the university does when you can tell an interesting story rather than simply say, we've got this FRIB project that's going to benefit Lansing to the tune of $500 million or whatever. But if you can tell the story of, Glassmacher, why he chose to come here and what he expects to discover with it, I think it's a lot more compelling to do it that way.
Any stories you wish you had the chance to tell that you haven't told?
I think there may have been, but, you know, I'm so obstinate in pursuing stories that I think most of the stories that I've wanted, I've figured out a way to do it.
That's an ongoing joke between Bob and me as I'll bring him a story idea, and he says, well, I wrote about that in 1987. What's your favorite place on campus outside of the golf course?
Yeah, I was going to say you know, probably Spartan Stadium, because I think, and a close second would be Breslin, because some of the most memorable moments have taken place, in those two places. The dorm that I lived in was Snyder Hall, and again, not to carbon date myself, but that was an era when the guys lived in Snyder and the gals lived in Phillips. You know, after the 60s, I think the dorms integrated. So today, if you say you're from Snyder or Phillips, it doesn't say anything about your gender, okay?
Just says you got a really good cafeteria in there, a really good eating place, yeah.
But we had a good group. I played bridge, and I often, you know, was down in the grill playing a bridge game or even a poker game. So I spent a lot of time you know, in Snyder Hall. Now, today, I also spend a lot of time over there eating at the gallery. It's a whole different concept. So that's a favorite place.
How would you like to be remembered?
Hopefully as somebody who really helped give the Alumni Magazine its current identity. When I first took over, I told you about the situation between the old Alumni Association and the then president. It was a tough situation because the alumni base, many alumni had been turned against the university as a result of that protracted fight. So you had to make amends, you know. And I think we created a magazine that really took care of all the major things that are of interest to alumni. And essentially, the magazine that we created, you know, obviously today we print in color. Back then it was black and white. But essentially, it stayed very, very similar to the way we started it. And it's kind of, you know, if you look at alumni magazines around the country, they've all kind of converged to a similar model. And we were very, very close to that. So, you know, I like to think of the MSU Alumni Magazine as always having a pulse on what Alumni Magazine should be.
Well, before I turn it back over to President Simon, I want to say that I can't think of anybody else editing the Alumni Magazine. I am very grateful to you for your friendship. You're one of the first people at the Alumni Association I met, and we met over email before we met in person. You were always very supportive, and you were the first guy that I took out for dinner when I got this job, because I knew you would be the guy who would be able to put perspective on what was, again, a very changing environment that I was faced with. And you've been a writing role model to me all along. I love when you say 600 words and I can give you 600 words. And I love how you tell a story, because I think that how I will always remember you is as Michigan State's quintessential storyteller. You made it possible for people who weren't there, even in situations where you weren't there, to feel like they were and to feel like they were there as Spartans. So on behalf of the Alumni Association, thank you for your three decades of service to Michigan State University.
Well, thank you, Scott. It's been a great ride, and you've been great. You've never missed the deadline.
You know, Bob, I want to sort of thank you again for all you've done for Michigan State University. We often talk about, you know, the tangibles, and those are the articles and the things that you've written that people can see and will be able to see forever in some ways. But there are also all the intangibles about how, through the lens that you've given others to see Michigan State and to feel what's special about Michigan State, that you've just done that in such an incredible way. And I want to personally thank you for all you've done for Michigan State.
Thank you, Lana. I have to say it was an easy job to sell Michigan State, because so many great things happened here, and especially in the last several years.
Well, you're very
a lot to talk about.
But you're very kind, but that lens is so important to be able to have the credibility of a true journalist, as one writes with insight and understanding and at some point appropriate criticism, at the same time have the affect that comes through your stories that people can really sense and feel Michigan State. So thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
That was Bob Bow, retiring editor of the MSU Alumni Magazine, talking with MSU Alumni Association Executive Director Scott Westerman and Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon. Check out Bob's great work at alumni.msu.edu/magazine. And to hear this conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com. Up next, Beale Botanical Gardens curator Frank Talewski.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. How many times have you been wearing your Spartan apparel in an airport and a voice in the crowd shouts, "Go green"? Well, that's happened to me in Beijing, Osaka, Kuala Lumpur, and Mumbai. And even in unlikely places like Ann Arbor and Columbus. There's a special bond we Spartans share, and that's at the foundation of everything we do at the MSU Alumni Association. As the world's largest organization of Spartans Helping Spartans, MSUAA truly is your personal network for life. From the moment you join, you've added thousands of fellow Spartans to your personal network, people who will pick up the phone and lend a hand just because you share Michigan State in common. That's the ethic that makes Spartans leaders, lifesavers, and world changers. And that's exactly what you'll find when you become an active member of the MSU Alumni Association. If you share this Spartan spirit, join us at alumni.msu.edu.
Doug Bueller leads MSU Ag Bio Research.
MSU Ag Bio Research is really located strategically within Michigan State University, and we concentrate on research in agriculture, natural resources, and energy.
MSU Ag Bio Research is changing the face of science.
Our mission really is wise use of the resources, both human and natural resources, and also to protect the productivity and profitability of our natural resource and agricultural systems.
More than 300 scientists from six MSU colleges are leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
Well, I think the most important thing we do is to continue to try to develop production systems that can put safe food on our plates, but also protect the environment, and also a situation where the producers can make a good living and protect their resources at the same time.
MSU Ag Bio Research, leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, my next guest is Dr. Frank Talewski. He's a professor of plant biology at Michigan State University. He's also the curator of the superb W.J. Beale Botanical Gardens and Campus Arboretum, also at Michigan State University. Frank, welcome to Greening of the Great Lakes.
Thank you.
Right, before we start talking about the impact of this recent weather on some of the trees on campus and around the state of Michigan, give our listeners a snapshot for those who have not had the pleasure of being to the Beale Botanical Gardens. What are the gardens? What do you guys do?
Ah, that's a good, very good question. The Beale Botanical Garden is a 5-plus acre plot located on the north campus between the library, the main library building, and the IM Circle building. And it was founded in 1873 by Professor William James Beale to meet the specific requirement that he had for teaching and research. And he always referred to the Beale Botanical Garden as an outdoor laboratory. And we hold true to Professor Beale's vision for the garden today in that we are an outside laboratory. We provide material for teaching. Many classes across the university, colleges, and systems come down to the garden to take advantage of our collections. We supply material that can go to laboratories for use for teaching. And we also supply material not only in the Beale Botanical Garden, but across the fabric of the Campus Arboretum. All of the trees on campus are part of our Campus Arboretum collection for researchers. And this past year alone, we were able to help supply material to researchers across MSU that in support of over $10 million worth of funded research, so sponsored research.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, in my research, it is the oldest continuously operating botanical garden of its kind in the United States?
Right. There's a couple of caveats there. And again, it's the oldest continuously operating botanical garden, certainly at a university. The Arnold Arboretum at Harvard was founded a year before we were. But they're an arboretum. We're a botanical garden. So again, but you know, we are very old, and we are been in a continuous operation since 1873 when Professor Beal first founded us.
Well, given the fact that Harvard was established in 1670 and we were around 1855, that's not bad.
No, it's not bad at all.
Recently, we've had some tough weather. I don't need to tell you that. And you do a lot of research on the impact of these kinds of storms, ice, what have you, cold, on trees, on other plants as well. What has been the impact on the campus?
Well, we had a quite extensive amount of damage, tree damage, limbs coming down, mostly limb damage, canopy damage to the trees. We've had a few trees that snapped off that'll have to be removed. And I did a survey over the holiday break, spending New Year's and New Year's Day on campus in that cold wind, along with some of my assistants. And we were actually measuring a lot of the branches and measuring the trees to actually record the amount of damage and try to quantify the amount of damage. And on North Campus alone, we have over 300 trees that were impacted with broken branches. Some, one or two branches, some significantly with a lot of branch damage.
So I think of trees as you do, as organisms. I mean, when they have this kind of damage, I mean, it's very similar to people breaking a limb or a leg or what have you. I mean, the impact on the trees can be rather devastating.
Yeah, fortunately for us humans, our bones will heal.
Yeah.
Trees don't heal. We can't reattach a limb. I mean, with humans, we've actually got the technology to reattach a limb. It wouldn't be economically feasible to do that for our trees. Fortunately, trees are very resilient and can regrow. And if they're not severely damaged, you can actually, not recognize the damage if the tree is properly cared for. And so in the case where we have a lot of these fractures, and the fractures are very fibrous breaks, our campus arborist, Paul Schwartz, who works in landscape services, will be doing a lot of pruning. His crew has been doing a lot of tree pruning to properly prune these broken branches off in such a way that the branches removed to a portion close to the stem, but in such a way that it allows the cambial tissue to continue to grow around the wound and seal that stub off. And if that tree can seal that stub off properly and contain that wound through compartmentalization, then that wound will not become infected and with decay and lead to further decline of the tree. If that surface is left fractured like that, the tree will never be able to properly seal it off, and it'll be open for an extended period of time, and that gives the opportunity for fungi and bacteria to enter into the wood system of the tree and cause it to decay and then lead to the decline of the tree. So proper arboricultural care at this point in time is very critical. We're going to have to wait with the cold and the ice and the snow. I know Paul Schwartz is estimating it's going to take months for his crew to address all of the trees on campus that have been damaged.
My guest is Frank Tolusky. He is a professor of plant biology at Michigan State and the curator of the W.J. Beal Botanical Gardens. So, Frank, you just sort of led into my next question. I'm one of those people. I've got fractured tree limbs down in my yard. It's been simply too cold to go out there and deal with it. My first thought was I'll just go out and deal with it myself. But what I'm hearing you say is homeowners really need to consult a professional when it comes to this kind of damage.
I would recommend that, and for a number of reasons. There's issues of safety, chainsaw safety, climbing into trees. If you get a certified arborist, someone who's had the training, who knows how to properly climb into a tree or has a bucket truck to properly get into the tree and then make the proper cuts. Because, again, this people refer to tree surgeons. Well, there is a level of surgery here that the cut has to be made properly in order to facilitate the tree to seal that wound off. If you don't, then actually that it'll be a nice clean cut. It'll look good to you. But the tree may not be able to recover and seal that wound properly. So it's very important to do that. If the individual knows what they're doing, certainly, then they could probably go out there and work on it themselves. But I wouldn't recommend it. You really need to know how to treat the tree. And certainly, if you're chainsawing above head level, you're threatening yourself. That's a very dangerous thing to be doing if you don't know what you're doing. And really, professionals can take care of that.
Now, that fibrous thing you were talking about is much more apparent in the hardwoods, but I also have some pine trees, and a lot of other people do. Is the same thing true of conifers, or is that you have a little bit more flexibility there?
It's very interesting how conifers responded. I've noticed that we had a lot of damage with white pine, eastern white pine, and the wood seems to be very brittle, or what we call a brash break, and so it actually kind of almost breaks off clean. But you still have that stub. And so that stub could be an entry point, even though it's not fibrous, for decay. And so pruning that back to the tree and cleaning that up properly, proper technique, would help the tree recover from this kind of damage. Some of the white pines I've noticed was very interesting in this storm is that we actually have what I call a branch junction failure, in that the branch, when it enters into the trunk of the tree, is literally ripped out. And you can actually see that knot-type configuration pulling out of the tree and leaving a hole in the tree. There's not a whole lot you can do about that with the hole in the tree. You just have to let that tree then seal that off by itself. You don't want to do any pruning. There's nothing to prune in that case.
That'd be similar to having a joint or an arm pulled out at the joint or something.
Well, exactly. That's what it is. It is the arm being pulled out of the joint. And if you look, the best way to visualize this is if you look at a piece of lumber and you see a knot in a piece of lumber, a knot is actually a branch junction. That knot is actually going to leave the tree and be a branch somewhere. Of course, when you're looking at it in a 2x4 or 2x12, it's a little bit harder to visualize that in its entirety.
So as you look forward to spring and hopefully some warmer weather here in the not-too-distant future, but what do you think the impact on campus, back to campus, is going to be? I mean, are there some things you're going to have to replant? Are there some trees that are going to have to be taken out?
We're going to have to take some trees out. We actually lost more trees in the windstorm a couple of weeks prior than we lost in the ice storm, but we have a lot of ice storm damage, and so the proper arboricultural technique with our tree crew to take care of that and ensure that our trees will recover and be resilient. But I think that we dodged a bullet. I think things could have been a lot worse. I was talking with our climatologist, Dr. Jeff Andreessen, on Tuesday, and he had mentioned that we got about 1/4 inch of ice accretion. And four-tenths of an inch, almost 1/2 inch of ice, and that we had over 1 inch of rainfall, and that we were very lucky because the upper-level atmosphere was so much warmer that when the rain fell through into the colder layer, it still had some thermal load to it, and it didn't freeze as instantaneously as it could have, and as did happen apparently over in Ontario, where they had 1 inch of accretion and just so much more significant damage than we did.
Your research expertise, you like to call it the biomechanics of trees, et cetera. If our listeners, if you had to tell them one or two things about the biomechanics of trees that they may not know, what are a couple of interesting factoids about the way trees operate?
Well, I think the most important thing that very few people realize is that trees can respond to their mechanical environment, particularly to wind loading and to ice and snow loading. A colleague of mine over at Swedish University in Umeå published a paper a few years ago that actually showed that pine trees loaded with snow and ice in the wintertime and shedding that ice would actually respond to increase the growth of their branches, increase the strength of their branches through the production of more wood with a different anatomical structure, micro-anatomical structure of cell walls and microfibrils that would facilitate them surviving another load of snow in the winter, the subsequent winters. The other thing is that trees can respond to wind, and that's one of my major areas. If you look at the library here on campus, you can actually see our trees that are planted on around that east wing of the library show a rather marked response to wind. And the stems are elliptical because the wind can only blow parallel to the face of the building, and
that's
those trees
amazing.
Sway back and forth. And so they strengthen themselves. So that trees are very dynamic organisms, and that they do sense their environment, and that they do respond to their environment, and particularly the mechanical environment. And this is very important for arborists. I'll be giving a talk in February for our Arboricultural Society of Michigan on the effect of this ice storm and some of the biomechanics factors. The different wood trees have different wood properties, mechanical properties, and some are going to be more resilient and some are going to be more vulnerable. And in an urban environment, and particularly along corridors, utility corridors, it's very important for us to understand which of these trees are going to be more vulnerable and maybe actually, through recommendations, remove these trees from those corridors and plant trees that are resilient if we need to have trees along a corridor for aesthetic purposes to try to reduce the infrastructural failures that we see during these kind of storms. And as a matter of fact, we have a program that we're working on with the University of Connecticut, Rutgers University, University of West Virginia, University of Massachusetts, and the U.S. Forest Service. A grant proposal that is actually being evaluated right now on what we're calling it StormWise, and it follows along the FireWise program that we have out in the western United States to increase the public's awareness of how to make your landscape, your home, and your community more stable for trees in an environment where we're beginning to see an increase in severity of storms. So we think of Hurricane Sandy, the Superstorm Sandy that hit the East Coast, Snowtober that hit New England. We can think of the ice storm that we just experienced here in Michigan. Right. You can think of some of the severe straight-line wind events that we had earlier in the fall. These are all very important factors that can damage infrastructure, result in massive losses to the economy. And if we can better understand the biomechanics of trees and better understand how trees are resilient and how trees can respond to cultivate them in that landscape in such a way that they will minimize failure, then we will be far, far further ahead than we are today.
Just one other aspect of preparing for these severe weather events that everybody seems to think are only going to increase with time.
Exactly, and certainly in terms of their severity.
Frank, we got a couple of seconds here, but those people who are maybe interested in a tour or even having a wedding or a special event at Beale Gardens, where can they go for more information?
We do have a webpage that they can visit, and if you do a Google search, Beale Botanical Garden, you should be able to find our webpage link, and that webpage does have access to information for weddings. We do host weddings down in the garden. That's not our primary function, but Right. Because we maintain a beautiful garden, we're very happy to have people down there. Had a wonderful opportunity last year, and so actually watched a couple get engaged down by the pond. Oh, so it is a very magical place and a very important place for people beyond its scientific and educational value.
A magical place indeed. I've been talking with Dr. Frank Talewski. He's a professor of plant biology at Michigan State University and also the curator of the W.J. Beale Botanical Gardens. Frank, thanks so much for being on the program.
Well, thank you very much.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
MLive Media Group is a Greening of the Great Lakes partner. To read Kirk's blog and to hear our show archives, please visit mlive.com/environment.
Please find us on Facebook by searching for Greening of the Great Lakes and follow us on Twitter at Green Michigan.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to 500,000 Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
Sundays at 4 o'clock, it's MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. MSU Today is a lively look at MSU-related people, places, events, and attitudes put into focus through conversations by MSU President Simon, Spartans A.D. Hollis, sustainability-focused Dr. Kirk Heinze, and me. MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR. Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.